Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of The Final Word, where we invite a special guest to pick their, well, they can pick whatever they want, it doesn't have to be their favourite, but they get the choice of any football final, international, national, domestic, European or global. We're on to episode 3, we've got the wonderful Jeff Goulding with us, but before we introduce Jeff and his chosen final, although it's not going to be a surprise which team are involved, we'll come to the man who is the brains behind this particular series. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, after the couple of episodes we've done already where there was lots of controversy around the game, rather than the game itself, this is it's a great opportunity to get the ball out the back and have a kick around. And I'm delighted to have one of my favourite authors of all time, Jeff, on board with us. And it's going to be a fascinating discussion.
It is. And like you say, I absolutely agree. And like you say, the first two have been about the most memorable finals for nothing to do with the 90 minutes.
Yeah. Obviously, we looked at the setting up with Zidane, and then we had Zidane again featuring the final when the controversy over Ronaldo, and was he fit, wasn't he fit, why didn't he play, why did he play, in fact. but this one's about football, so... We're gonna get the ball out and have a kick around.
Excellent, Stephen. Again, you must be champing at the bit to get into this one.
Oh yeah, you'd think I'd set it up, but I've not.
I often think that. To be fair,
I won't say anything.
You would think I'd steered this into being, but it's nothing to do with me. It's all I'm just along for the ride.
Before we get into it, where does this rank? Obviously, with regards to the date and when it was played, but. For you, where does this rank in terms of Liverpool performances in finals, Stephen?
One of the finest. Some of the football they played in this final was, it was ahead of its time, really. It was the performance that kind of pivoted Liverpool towards the team that would eventually go on to lift that first European Cup 3 years later. Some of the hallmarks of that side that would go on to dominate Europe were evident at Wembley that day.
I'm glad you said that, because when I was rewatching it, I was just thinking that. But obviously with the people we've got on, I'm very loath to make any sort of comment about Liverpool's development or progression. And obviously, Jeff, it's no surprise because you've been in the bottom right-hand corner since we started. But welcome to the series, and obviously, thank you for agreeing to come on and talk about Stephen's team and your team, but Stephen's team. It's the 1974 FA Cup final between Liverpool and Newcastle United. As always, first question, of all the finals in all the world, why did you pick this one?
Well, I mean, Stephen's absolutely right. And in the years that have gone by since that final, I've watched it over and over again. I've read absolutely masses around the final and lots of analysis about the game. But I've actually picked it entirely for emotional reasons, really, and nostalgic reasons, because this was the first game featuring Liverpool that I'm conscious or can remember watching and actually being, really engrossed and interested in the game. I was born in 67, so I'd have been 6 years of age when this game was playing. So I wouldn't have had any particular knowledge about the build-up to the game at the time. But for me, it was a big occasion. It was a big family occasion. I think I was definitely aware that my family were Liverpool supporters. And by extension, I was most likely a Liverpool supporter. But that was the game that kind of sealed the deal for me. And I kind of just remember the whole occasion, really. So the family were around, they had cousins around. There was nowhere for people to sit. I was sat on the floor with my cousins in front of the television. Watching the build-up, watching the game. My mum and dad, my aunts and uncles are all there. And it was kind of just watching their reactions, I think, on the day and experiencing all the emotion of the game. that really probably sealed it for me in terms of becoming a, you know, being a committed Liverpool supporter, or a Liverpool supporter who should be committed, I'm not sure. but I think, you know, every time Liverpool are in a competition since then, and every, you know, every season since then, I'm pretty convinced that part of the desire to see them end up winning a trophy is about reliving those moments with family and friends, you know, the emotion of it all, and wanting to sort of go back to that in your mind somewhere, you know. So that's it, you know, it sort of stands out as the kind of bedrock of why I'm a Liverpool supporter of that game. And of course, you know, what a game to, you know, if you're going to pick your first game to watch, then, you know, this is an incredible one, you know. Shankly, you know, the images of him conducting the team on the pitch, it's like he was a magician. The players, you know, the performance was incredible. Keegan scoring two goals. Keegan was a hero. And obviously, since I've kind of learned more about the game and watched it over and over again, but it was kind of very much an emotional deal at the time, and it's stuck with me ever since.
There we go. You see, Gary, now that's what we were after, isn't it? When you came up with the series, that's what we were after. I suppose I'll come to you first, Gary. It's funny, the very first game that I can remember watching is the FA Cup final, and it's the 1978 one between Ipswich and Arsenal, and I was six, and obviously I'm not an Ipswich Town fan, but that's the game, that's the very first conscious thought I have I did sit through the full game, but I guess the point is, Gary, it's like, because there was so little football on back then, there was a high likelihood that the FA Cup final was probably going to be your introduction to sort of live football, whether you were 5, 6, 7, maybe 8, it was going to be the FA Cup final, wasn't it?
Yeah. Give my age away. I mean, the first cup final I can remember was West Ham and Preston, which I think was 63. Now, I remember Liverpool winning the FA Cup in 65 as well. And it's, you know, when you sort of you look back on the era of the 70s and 80s and the domination of Liverpool, it's almost incredible to believe that in 1974 Liverpool had only won the FA Cup once before that final. It's fascinating to hear Jeff say the reason why he picked it, but I was doing some research today, obviously, on the game, and it almost was like a launch pad for Liverpool as well, because the period of domination the club enjoyed after that was, you know, literally staggering. And, it's strange that sometimes winning a first trophy in a big final, the biggest step in the world is 0-1, 1-2 million is like falling off a log after that. And I tell you what, Liverpool did have to fall off some logs after it.
Because I watched the game back yesterday, and it, obviously just chatting about FA Cup finals, and certainly I always associate the FA Cup final with the old Wembley, the sun, the heat, and that sort of thing. But Steve, when you watch that FA Cup final, the thing when I watched it back the other day, the thing that drew my eye was was how red Liverpool's kit was. And I know that sounds really weird, but it was a really grey, overcast day that game was played in, and it sort of seemed an air of inevitability based on the sort of the scene in front of you. Obviously, Newcastle playing in black and white seemed. They just seemed really insipid and just sort of blended into the background. And everything, watching that game back, was just dominated by red. And again, as a kid, you know, as Jeff was saying there, if you're looking for a team to support, or it's your first introduction to football, it can be something as simple as the redness of a kit or how a team looks that can, well, put you on a journey for the rest of your lives.
Yeah, totally agree. You know, it's that vivid kind of, you know, aura about that kit and those players on that day, set against what was quite a grey backdrop, really. You know, we aren't talking about an era where people are tipping up at the game in, you know, modern sports where, you know, the ultras are a few seasons away. All of that is still waiting to unfold. So people are tipping up in what is pretty much, you know, grey 1970s leisure wear. You know, you look at the bench, the camera pans to the bench. There's, you know, a very kind of stoic looking set of football coaches, shall we say. And then suited, you know, the players behind who aren't involved on the day are sat there in the cup final suits. and yet, and then there is the greenness of the pitch, and it is it's Liverpool in that red strip, and it does, it stands out against what is quite a monotone background.
It's interesting to hear Stevie say that, because I hope Newcastle fans will forgive me for saying this, but the game was decided by Liverpool dominated the game, and they were in colour and Newcastle were in black and white. Mm.
That, like I say, that's exactly how it seemed to me. I mean, I guess, Jeff, you've explained and put it together beautifully, as you do with words, why this game was so special, and the life changing impact that it has. But I suppose that I asked Stephen the question earlier with regards to Liverpool's sort of, where does it rank in terms of Liverpool's performances and finals? And Gary's mentioned, there were so many finals that came afterwards. But for you as a Liverpool fan, and obviously you can go right up to Istanbul and beyond and European Cup wins, but does this FA Cup win, is it the most special final for you?
Yeah, I think it still is. I mean, I think Liverpool have won lots of finals, obviously, since then, particularly in the 70s and 80s. But For the sheer flamboyance of that performance, particularly the second half, and I know we'll talk about the game later, but Liverpool dominated the first half, but they didn't make the breakthrough in the first half. But for the sheer flamboyance of that performance, the creativity, the goals they scored. I mean, even Tommy Smith, plays an absolutely beautiful 1-2, I think it's with Ian Callaghan, and the crossover for Keegan's goal. Tommy Smith is, famed for being a bit of a clogger, a bit of a hard man, a hard tackler, and probably no one cultivated that image of Tommy Smith more than Tommy Smith did. But he could play football, and I think they had footballers all over the pitch in that game. And, we played lots of finals since then, but for sheer sort of dominance and flamboyance of football, there's few that I can think of. I mean, even the great ones that have been incredibly exciting, like the Dortmund final and the Gerrard FA Cup final and Istanbul, they're great finals for, heroic comebacks and crazy scorelines. This was a great final because Liverpool were absolutely magnificent in that final. And of course, we look back on it with the benefit of hindsight now, and we realise that, as has already been said, Liverpool had, the season before, had ended a 7-year drought. They'd won the league and the UEFA Cup, and they were about to go on another incredible journey. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be with Bill Shankly; it'd be with a different manager. But So the straightforward answer to your question is yes. I think it is probably the most special cup final that I can remember in my lifetime.
Brilliant. I love it when we get into these and guests sort of get so passionate they kind of forget where they are and you just lose yourself in the game, and it's great. And you're right, we will get to the game because it's a great game to talk about. Just before that, Gary, and I know this isn't meant to sound rude and it's going to, and I'm really sorry. You've seen more FA Cup finals than us. I don't know how else to say it. Obviously, Manchester City's against Watford and the sort of 6-0 demolition is incredibly one-sided. But, for you, is it one of the most one-sided finals you can remember?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Certainly, as you said, the City one was, okay, far away. The biggest I can remember, the cup final. But, I don't think Newcastle were ever in the game, really. And it was such a big deal for Newcastle because Sunderland had won the FA Cup the year before. So, Newcastle winning it would have been such a big thing for the Geordies to sort of level one up with the Mackems, as it were. And Liverpool had finished second in the league behind Leeds by, 4 or 5 points. But Newcastle were down in 15, 16 position. They'd just scraped away from relegation by a couple of points. And you look at the relative form of teams going into cup finals sometimes, and it doesn't play out. This one did. Liverpool were dominant, and although they didn't score in the first half, they had plenty of chances, near misses, and that sort of thing. But once the dam was broke, once Keegan got that first goal, you couldn't see any of the results. Newcastle were earnest, Liverpool were flamboyant and devastating attack. Toshack and Keegan, their prime, wonderful. And as Jeff said, Keegan was brilliant in the game, impish, full of pace, direct, running the defence, Bobby Moncourt, you know, he must have had nightmares afterwards. There's just a couple of little things in the about the game though, about the teams. There were two players for Newcastle United who would both win the European Cup with other clubs. One was Alan Kennedy, who was moved to Liverpool, obviously won the European Cup with Liverpool. And the other was Frank Clark, who had the distinction of playing in the Inter-City Affairs Cup final a decade or so before when Newcastle won it, and then played in the final when Forest won it. So two Newcastle players on that day actually played in the European Cup, but won the European Cup as well. But as you say, the difference in the side was, you know, sometimes Wembley's a great evener. Not on this occasion, it was.
before we get into the game, I suppose one last question for you, Stephen, was, you know, sort of Jeff mentioned earlier there that, you know, it would, you know, you both said that it would lay the platform for European dominance, for want of a better word, but it would be done with a different manager. Is this final the sort of crystallisation of Shankly as a manager of Liverpool? Is this the game that is sort of held up as what he did, what he achieved, how he got Liverpool to play?
It is. It's the point of passing the baton on. You know, it's almost like a hybrid of Shankly and Paisley's side. You know, you still have the Toshack in there. You know, there is still that concept of getting the ball in high into the penalty area for the knock-on for Keegan and any number of rushing on midfielders. You know, Highway would still pull wide at times, but at the same time, there was that hallmark of Paisley on there as well. So whether that was his influence starting to permeate over the last few years, I mean, he was upgraded to assistant manager in 71. So for the last 3 years, you know, his remit at Liverpool was as high as it could be without being manager. So, you know, whether it was a conscious thing or a subconscious thing, you know, maybe over those years that Shankly was listening to Paisley a little bit more and maybe, you know, taking more of his ideas on board. You know, this was a Liverpool side that had been taught some very, very interesting European lessons over the recent seasons, none more so than earlier in the season against Red Star Belgrade, which many rate as being the epiphany for Liverpool to transform the defence from a stopping set of central defenders into a ball-playing set of central defenders. I think there's a little bit more to it for me. You know, it's a mix of two things. You know, part of it was by chance, part of it was by design. But yes, for me, this Liverpool side, and sorry, I just had a third European Cup winner in there in Terry McDermott.
Yes.
As well.
Boom!
this was a Liverpool that was evolving. That was the way that this Liverpool did in the 1970s, is that they evolved. Shankly had that, what is often referred to as his first great side. I don't like calling it his first great side. His first great side was the team that won promotion from the second division. You know, his second great side was the team that won the title and the FA Cup, and then the title again in the mid-60s, because there's quite a few alterations to that side, to the one that wins promotion. And then comes his early 70s side that, you know, comes to shape in the 1971 FA Cup final against Arsenal, then wins the league title and UEFA Cup double in 72-73, having only just missed out in the 70-71. So 71-72 title. So by 73-74, he's added certain elements to that. Peter Cormack, you know, that can't be, you know, his influence can't be, you know, diminished. It's little subtleties. It's the fact that little subtleties are starting to move into the Liverpool pattern of play. You know, it's the shifting of Ian Callaghan as he reaches his 30s. He is shifted from the right side of midfield essentially as a right winger. Not an out winger, but he would play right side. He was moved in his early 30s to central midfield, and it put another 6, 7, 8 years onto his career at Liverpool. You know, it was little tweaks like that. You know, eventually we would stop using out and out wingers as such and have midfielders, wide midfielders that would tuck in, which would allow the fullbacks to bomb on and be attacking. We look today at Trent Alexander-Arnold and Anthony Robertson and how well they play. You know, if you want to see the prototypes for them, watch at least the second half of this final. You know, Tommy Smith and Alec Lindsay in this final are imperious with their attacking play from fullback. And this is a Tommy Smith as well, who wasn't really a fullback. You know, he'd shifted from centre-back earlier in the season to cover for Chris Lawler being injured. Did so well, he stayed there, because it was one of those things that helped change the Liverpool central defence. You know, it had been Larry Lloyd and Tommy Smith. And while Smith could play, he was primarily there to stop people scoring. So this partnership in central defence between Smith and Lloyd was a traditional set of stoppers as such. By the time this FA Cup final comes around, it's Phil Thompson and Emlyn Hughes. Emlyn Hughes has dropped back to cover for Tommy Smith as he covers at right back. And then when Lloyd gets injured at the beginning of February, Phil Thompson, who people don't really realise started out as a central midfielder, drifts back into central defence. That performance, and he was arguably Liverpool's better central defender that day. That is a performance. It's not that he's just that he's 20 years old. He's only been playing in the role for 3 months, 12 weeks in that role. You know, it and this is against Malcolm McDonald, the Supermac. You know, he told everyone what he was going to do going into this final. But there's Phil Thompson, you know, there to stop him. And when he switches sides because he gets frustrated, there's Emlyn Hughes to stop him. Yet both of them push up so far that they almost play like a set of central midfielders. At times, it's almost like Liverpool don't play with a defence in this final.
That is the ultimate statement, isn't it? Before we get into, because like I say, this is a final, certainly the first episode that we've done where it is about the football. But in terms of getting there, Jeff, and the cup run, obviously, you know, we've chatted a little bit about the development of this squad over a prolonged period of time under Shankly, but sort of that season and the cup run that gets the sides there, you know, including Newcastle in this as well. But did it seem in hindsight that Liverpool were always destined for success in this competition in this season?
No. Looking back, and you could say the same for Newcastle as well. The first two rounds of the competition, both teams had to go to replays in order to get through. Liverpool struggled against a team that was the bottom team in all four divisions, Doncaster Rovers, who came to Anfield and got a 2-2 draw at Anfield. And they'd actually taken the lead. Liverpool took the lead after 3 minutes. They equalised after 6 minutes and then went ahead midway through the first half. It was Keegan who equalised in the second half to spare their blushes. And, you know, reading newspaper reports, I've not seen this game, but reading newspaper reports of that game, you know, Doncaster probably deserved what they got out of the game. Liverpool had to go to a replay. They won the replay. Interestingly, Liverpool played a few fringe players. In doing sort of research around this cup run, Liverpool played a few fringe players in the early rounds of the competition, the likes of Trevor Staunton, who they'd signed from Tranmere Rovers under Shankly. I think it was the season before. And Dave Rylands, who'd signed professionally. He was a local lad. He'd signed professionally in 1970. And, I mean, David Rylands never played a game after that game against Doncaster Rovers. And Trevor Staunton only had, it was Trevor Staunton never played a game after that. Dave Rylands, I think, only played 22 times for Liverpool. So Liverpool sort of struggled against Doncaster, and then they had a kind of another hiccup, as it were, against Carlisle United. They had another draw. I think it was a 0-0 draw again at Anfield in the third round. And so really, you know, you couldn't say their sort of early sort of outing in the competition that it looked like they were destined to go on and reach the FA Cup final. By the time they get to the fifth round, they get drawn against Bobby Robson's Ipswich. And looking through that team sheet, you've got some sort of legendary players from Ipswich, you know, the likes of George Bailey, Mick Mills, Alan Hunter, Kevin Beattie. And of course, David Johnson, who would go on to play for Liverpool later on, a Scouse lad. And Liverpool beat Ipswich 2-0 and thoroughly deserved. So they kind of sort of found their feet in the competition by the fifth round of the competition. For Newcastle, it was very, very similar. Liverpool beat Bristol City in the sixth round. They beat them 1-0. But for Newcastle, it was very similar. You know, they had a couple of difficult games early on. But the absolute standout game for Newcastle in that cup run will have been the game in the semi-final against Nottingham Forest, because that was an absolute battle in many respects. So Forest had gone 3-1 up after a penalty, I think. And the Newcastle fans were so incensed by the penalty, there was a pitch invasion during the game. The game was kind of halted for a period of time. Two Forest players were injured in the melee. There was hundreds of supporters injured, and I think 29 people were hospitalised. And incredibly, you know, there was a clamour for Newcastle to be disqualified from the competition. But incredibly, the FA, which was an unprecedented decision, the FA ordered that the game be replayed at Goodison Park. It went to two replays, and eventually Newcastle won the game 1-0 with a Super Mac goal, a Malcolm McDonald goal, I think, later on in the game. So, you know, you couldn't say, looking at both those cup runs, by any stretch, that they were destined to, you know, I mean, Newcastle's cup run was remarkable in so many ways. And of course, then they get to the final, and Stephen's right, you know, the all the talk before the game, and I kind of looked through all the press previews before the game, and all the talk is about Malcolm McDonald and Tudor. You know, a lot of journalists had Newcastle to win the game, and you know, Liverpool were called in. I read a Mirror report that suggested that Liverpool were predictable, and that, you know, McDonald and Tudor would get in behind Liverpool and cause all sorts of problems. And of course, McDonald played up to that. Now, whether legend has it that that was kind of pinned up in the dressing room, and that was used to fire the players up before the game. But whatever happened, you know, McDonald made a big mistake by with his hubris before the game. Really,
it's. I mean, you know, as Jeff's just gone through, you know, gone through the cup run there, Gary. It's, and you kind of you forget, or I would imagine certainly people who are a lot younger than us, for you kind of forget what a slog the FA Cup could be. Sort of back in the day it was, you know, it could be a real slog to win, you know, to win the competition. It didn't go to penalties, it was, you know, it was constant replays. You know, I'm not saying it was any more easier to win then as it was now. You know you've still got to win seven games, or, you know, but it just seemed to be a bit more of a battle, or the format of the competition meant that it could be a really long, drawn-out process to get to a final.
Definitely. And, you know, Jeff mentioned about the struggles Liverpool had with Doncaster and Carlisle. In the third round, Newcastle drew Hendon, non-league club at home, and drew 1-1 with Hendon at home. I mean, that's hardly suggestive of glory somewhere down the road in May. They won the replay 4-0. And in the next round, they got Scunthorpe, I think it was, again at home, and drew before winning the replay. So, yeah, you know, there was, you know, as Jeff quite rightly says, neither team were really sort of saying, it's our cup this season, guys. there was no sort of pedigree suggested, certainly in the early rounds. But as you say, Stu, these were the days when, you know, teams didn't necessarily rest players very much like they do now, entire squads. You know, Jeff mentioned about Liverpool playing a few squad players, but that was sort of noticeable because it was unusual. Certainly there wouldn't be sort of 7, 8, 9 changes as you see these days. And obviously the early rounds are played in the winter, so the pitches were a bit sloggy, as well as the sort of progress being sloggy. And, you know, to get to the FA Cup final and the sunshine you mentioned, and Wembley and the bright colours and the green grass, and you had to get through a lot of hard work to get there.
And following on from that, Stephen, you know, we talk about this a lot, but it's sort of worth remembering as well, is just how important the FA Cup was at this time. You know, for me, you know, as you sort of come into the sort of early 70s and through into the 80s, you know, it's a real heyday, you know, for the FA Cup as a competition, you know, for the teams that win it. You know, we've talked about it before as players, you know, when they look back on their career, do they want to look back in at fourth place finishes for 7 or 8 seasons, or do they want to look back at one FA Cup winner's medal perhaps, and, you know, and not a fourth place finish? It's, you know, to me, this game is played in a time where it really mattered as a competition.
Oh, massively, massively mattered. You're always left with the impression that it was like the biggest day of their club career, at the very least. You know, yes, as in, you know, international football and going to a World Cup and stuff like that, you know, is, you know, comparable or a rival. Winning the league title, always absolutely massive, but that cup final day always was made to feel like it was massive. There was a sense of trepidation about it because there'd always be a player that was, you know, walking a disciplinary tightrope, you know, one booking away from missing the final. You know, there's always those games in the lead up to the final where, you know, a player would pick up an injury. You know, there would always be, you know, in that era of only having one substitute, there would be the 13th man, the unlucky 13th man who would miss out on playing. You know, in this respect, in this final for Liverpool, that was Phil Borsma, who was a bit of a pacey striker that could run with the ball at his feet and would often keep John Toshek out of the side, especially away from home. Many people were expecting him to be on the bench to have the number 12 shirt, and he didn't. Bill Shankly went with Chris Lawler instead because of the greater options, basically. You know, with Chris Lawler on the bench, you know, whoever got injured on the pitch, apart from the goalkeeper, there was a way of bringing him on and moving other players around to cover every position, and that wasn't the case with Borsma. But within that, you know, there was the kind of like the drama of it was that, you know, this was a decision that was left till late. It was only shortly before the game, maybe an hour before the game, that Shankly made his choice. And when the choice was made, Borsma, you know, just walked out of Wembley. He was that, you know, gutted about it. He got in a car, got in a taxi and went back to the hotel, didn't even watch the game. Went and found his girlfriend and watched her in a play that night who was acting in London. So it's all these little side stories and stuff like that, and, you know, the joys of those who win, and it goes well for the heartbreak for those who goes badly, not just in the case of losing, but not even, you know, the heartbreak of a player who's missed out on the 12 places available. You know, the fine lines, but it was the way that it was made to feel like the biggest day of the calendar, and it was really, because it was the only, pretty much the only live domestic game that we had until 83-84 was the season that they started having, you know, at least semi-regular league football on live on a, you know, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday afternoon. So up until kind of like the mid-80s, the FA Cup final was largely it as far as a game between two English sides were to be live on the television. So it was that, we've used the word before, that sense of occasion. And for many, many reasons, the FA Cup final had a massive sense of occasion. So
yeah, and I think just to add to that very briefly is that, of course, the thing that separates the FA Cup final from the European Cup and the UEFA Cup is, This is against a domestic rival, isn't it?
It is, and especially if it's a local domestic rival.
Yeah,
that sense of fear in losing. Yeah. I remember the Everton final, you know, in 86, maybe less so in 89 because of what had happened beforehand. But 86, I can remember being gripped by this inordinate fear of losing that game to the point that, you know, didn't enjoy it at all until kind of like the third goal went in. You know, stuff like that. So it was,
and of course, the 77 against United was devastating, wasn't it? Because you know, it's losing to them down the road. So yeah, it was big, huge final.
But then later on, it starts to lose its lustre in that respect, because it becomes, I don't know, not just another game, but almost like an afterthought that you've got to crowbar into the equation. You know, Man United not playing in, was it 99-2000 to go and play in the World Club Cup? Instances like, you know, playing the cup final on the same date, there's still a, you know, Premier League programme of fixtures, shifting the kickoff to 5:15, like the most unattractive weekend kickoff time imaginable. You know, even down to teams who would have a European final or a big Premier League game the following weekend of an FA Cup final, resting players. Imagine player being rested for the FA Cup final. Because there's a supposedly bigger game beyond that. You know, that had never happened. You know, we're turning around and saying about the 74 final there and certain players missing out. I think Newcastle were the same. Barraclough, who was a decent winger for Newcastle, who might have been able to come on and give them a bit of impetus, wasn't there. You know, the more percentage player, Gibbs was on the bench for them. So, yeah, so you're going from that perspective of the heartbroken player who can't be involved or loses on the day to players being rested for other games. It's, you know, but yeah, you know, going back, it was that sense of occasion. It was absolutely massive. And you're right what you said earlier on, Stu, about it being the old Wembley. You know, as you go to the old Wembley in person, you until you go, you never realise just how much of a hole it was. But, you know, Wembley, I've always turned around and said that Wembley looks so much better on the television than it does in person. But on cup final day, and especially a sunny cup final day, which 1974 wasn't, and the way that the sun would catch the stands, and then you would have the arc of the stands on the shadow of the pitch, it just looked the most majestic thing. That long walk from the tunnel at the far end, you know, all of it, you know, there was just that sense of kind of the massive sense of occasion, you know, massive.
It's, I mean, like we say, I mean, when Gary mentioned this series and sort of certainly for our generation, I assumed there would be a number of FA Cup finals, I guess, because like Stephen said, you know, it's sort of all we knew growing up in terms of live football. But sort of coming to the game, Jeff, you know, we've talked a lot around the game and the players and, you know, the build-up to it, which is great. But obviously, it is a one-sided, it's an incredibly one-sided game, as Gary's mentioned as well. But in terms of key moments, like you say, it's nil-nil at half-time, but it's a very, what you want to call it, a very generous nil-nil, I think is probably what you would call it. Ultimately, it's nil-nil. The teams go in level, but they're not really level at half-time. In terms of the game then, you know, key moments for you that decide it, or key moments, I suppose, that stand out, you know, maybe as a child, as a six-year-old, or key moments in hindsight where you look back and go, actually, it's there, that's where it changed, or that's where the game sort of changed, or the game was confirmed. You know, how do you, in terms of looking back at it, where do you see the key moments in this final?
I mean, looking back as a child, watching the game, it's difficult to pick out, you know, what stood out for me in terms of a moment of the game. It is the things that we've already talked about in terms of Liverpool's kit, Kevin Keegan's sideburns, you know, I mean, watching it since as well, the thing that stands out to me, which is kind of an interesting aspect, really, in that you listen to the crowd, you listen to the Liverpool supporters singing in 1974, and you can hear the Scouse accent in a way that you can't hear it now. And that's not a bad thing that we have supporters from different parts of the country and the world in the crowd singing today, but it's just remarkable that stands out so much. It's very much a different era when Liverpool's fan base would have been predominantly local compared to the way it is now. Watching it back since then, you know, I think, yes, you're right, it was completely one-sided game from start to finish. But I think the moment that kind of felt like it broke the logjam was Alec Lindsay's goal. It was Alec Lindsay scored the goal that got disallowed for offside. It was an absolutely brilliant move, wasn't it? It was a counter-attacking move. He played a 1-2 off Keegan, and looking at the replays, it looks like it comes off Keegan's boot, and so it shouldn't probably have been disallowed. But I think that kind of, that was, they'd broken through and they got the goal. And of course, they went on and scored the goal that was ultimately the first goal. They scored that a few moments later. And I think I've spoken to people who were there, and I've kind of obviously read a lot around the game, and a lot of people who were there watching the game said that when Lindsay got that goal, you kind of felt like we would do it. You kind of felt like we would break through and we would get the win. And obviously Liverpool went ahead and scored again a few moments later. And from that moment on, you know, people who were in the grounds, people who remember it more than I do because they were older at the time, you know, tend to say that, you know, really there was no doubt in anyone's mind after Liverpool went 1-0 up. You know, Clemens had very little to do for the rest of the game. In fact, I think it was his punt up the pitch, wasn't it, with 15 minutes to go that kind of led to the second goal. So for me, it's those two moments in the second half, really, Alec Lindsay's disallowed goal and then Liverpool going 1-0 up, that kind of just put the seal on the game, I think, and left. I think the players probably were in no doubt it was going to be their day, and possibly Newcastle. If the penny hadn't already dropped, I think it probably dropped at that moment.
To be fair, it's a great point. I did have a different question for Gary, actually, but what you've just mentioned there, Jeff, I'll ask Gary. Just sometimes, and I guess, you know, none of us have been pro players in FA Cup finals, I'm aware of that, but I suppose just sometimes there must be rare occasions in a professional's life, as Jeff just said there, where you kind of just know that you reach a certain point in the game, and it must be incredibly rare, but it must be quite a surreal moment to sort of be participating in a game and be as confident as you can ever be or will ever be that you are going to win this final.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I was watching it earlier today. And you know, as we've all said, Liverpool absolutely dominated the game, and Leeds' goal definitely should have stood because Keegan didn't touch the ball. He come off. It was Pat Howard, I think it was, who sort of basically played the wall pass with Lindsay when he scored. And if VAR, that's a goal tiger. But anyway, just take what you say. Although, you know, and it did sort of say, okay, you know, breaking the dam, and Keegan's putting for head not long afterwards. But with 15 minutes to play, it was a 1-0 lead. Now, at 1-0, there's always a danger. A corner, a free kick, a mistake. You know, and with 15 minutes to play, you think, is this possible that Liverpool could not win this after dominating so strongly? And then, you know, the Highway score, and that, you know, well, Newcastle weren't going to score twice, that's for sure. In fact, they weren't going to score once, but you never know. And I think, you know, Liverpool players would probably have been confident, but I can't imagine that there would still have been a doubt in the mind at 1-0. There must still have been that sort of threat that, you know, one mistake, let's say a corner, a free kick, anything could happen in the game of football. Just, you know, a goal can be scored any time when 1-0 is a dangerous lead. But, you know, I'm sure they're as confident as any team at 1-0 could be. But once Highway scored, it was time to get the pipe and flippers out. And, you know, and Tommy Smith, you know, Jeff referred to earlier, he created the third goal for Keegan. Like some kind of sort of Cristiano Ronaldo duplicate hammering down the right wing, playing a 1-2 with Brian Hall, Martin, I can't remember.
Yeah, and
Keegan to stab home, you know, icing on the cake, cherry on the top. Thank you very much, guys. Good evening.
I mean, Stephen, we talked about it last week when we did the last recording, and that's, as a kid, how difficult it was to rewatch a full game, and how it wouldn't hold your interest. You'd be like, oh, I don't want to watch it again. I know what the score is. Just show me the highlights. But as we've got older, we've sort of agreed that actually that there is a lot to be said for rewatching games. And like I say, if you're I teach at a college, there's a lot of Liverpool fans there who have sort of, I won't say grown up with Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool, but, you know, they're sort of 16 now, so that sort of 12, 13 to 16, all they've known is this current period of success and, you know, sort of borderline dominance, or certainly being, you know, in with a shout with things. But it's a great point that you mentioned earlier about comparing Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson to, you know, go back to 74. And I suppose this is one of those games where you can actually pinpoint almost a changing of the game. You know, we've talked before about how people come into the game and change it. There are so few and far between. And sometimes you can watch performances or watch a team who do revolutionise either the way the game is played, or it revolutionises the way a club are perceived, or the direction that it takes the club into. And rewatching the full 90 minutes of this is, for me, is one of those games.
It is, because there's so many kind of like signs there that you see. You know, the way that Smith and Lindsay get forward is very, very, you know, forward thinking. You know, Chris Lawler had been doing that for a good few years at right back. You know, he would have revelled in a game like this. You know, he scored over, I think, 60 odd goals for Liverpool.
High-scoring fullback, isn't he?
Yeah, from right back, and not one of them was a penalty. You know, this wasn't a penalty taker. This was someone who he was actually called him the ghost, because he would ghost in at the back post, and the ball would be somewhere over there with Chris Lawler, you know, unassuming at the back post, knocking the ball in. So, you know, Liverpool did have this propensity for the attack and fullback, but the way that it was done in the 74 Cup final was that it was both sides. So rather than one or the other, this was both, you know, fullbacks going for it. You know, for Lindsay to have that goal disallowed, and for Smith to play the part that he did in that third goal. I mean, that third goal is just one of the greatest FA Cup final goals of all time. You know, it's the 13, 14 passes from 8 different players involved. In the build-up to it, the way that it switches from one side back to the other and then back over again. You know, that one deft touch with the outside of his right foot after the ball's played by Keegan from the opposite side of the pitch, you know, that's the Tommy Smith. You know, this is Tommy Smith. You know, people who think was just a hatchet man. No, and he wasn't. The interesting thing about this Liverpool side was that Smith in his younger days started higher up the pitch. Emlyn Hughes and Phil Thompson at centre-back, both central midfielders. You know, Lindsay played on the left-hand side of midfield as a kid. You know, this was a team that, you know, Ray Clements in goal, you know, in his youth days, he was an outfield player and ended up as a goalkeeper by, you know, almost error as much as design, to the point that he used to play Anfield training sessions, the five-a-sides. He'd play outfield because he still fancied himself as a bit of an outfield player. All of these players at the Liverpool back line were football players. They weren't just defenders and goalkeepers. They were footballers. And this is what is quite interesting about this Liverpool side, because that metamorphosis that is going on, some over the period of time, they stopped being an English side, to the point that, you know, I've just been writing about the 1977 European Cup final, for instance, the last few days. reading a lot of the build-up to it, and Udo Lattek, the Borussia Mönchengladbach coach, who spoke about his respect for Liverpool and how European they were. And this is where you're seeing signs of that. There's a lot of subtle intelligence in the way that Liverpool took to the 1974 FA Cup final. You know, especially in the first half, in the way that Ian Callaghan sprayed the ball around and just split the play. You know, it was just picking out the passes. You know, this was kind of like, you know, talk about Xavier and Iniesta, or you know, later on Xavi Alonso, or this was Jan Mobley-esque, some of his passing. You know, what Brian Hall was doing was he didn't go man marking on Terry Hibbert, but anytime Terry Hibbert got the ball, he was very quick on him. And what Newcastle would do is Terry Hibbert would play a long ball to Malcolm McDonald. This was one of their tactics, and how they would play long diagonal balls from roughly the halfway line. They wouldn't even, you know, aim for the byline. They'd be playing these percentage balls from distance for McDonald to run onto, to use his power and his pace. So the concept was that Brian Hall would close down Hibbert. He couldn't play the long ball, you know, and it happened again and again and again. Hall had the freedom to play, hence he couldn't have played the role that he did in that third goal, because he played a big part in that role. Hall was the player who ducks under the ball when Keegan opens the scoring for the first goal. So he had a lot of freedom to his role that day. But at the same time, if Newcastle got the ball, he magnetically closed the space on Hibbert, and it starved McDonald. You know, so you know, it was cutting off the lungs of the Newcastle side. So yes, Liverpool were expansive. Yes, Liverpool were playing a very continental game of football, increasing in confidence. But at the same time, they were still stifling Newcastle. The way Newcastle played was as much down to how Liverpool dealt with them as it was Newcastle not showing up.
As you mentioned, Jeff, it was always going to be longer than 45 minutes, and we are at just about 50 minutes already. But that's okay. Yeah, listening to you guys speak, and you know, obviously certainly listening to you and Stephen, and what I'm interested in, and one of the bits that Gary sort of picks, which is really good, is to what goes on to happen to the sort of the two finalists. And I don't want to upset Newcastle fans, but there's not really a lot to talk about. However, in terms of Liverpool, the period, and it's kind of always fascinated me, and certainly now I've got the opportunity to talk to you guys, is that period between 74 and 77, in terms of in-depth and, you know, people who know about the club and know about the side, you know, what happens that enables this club to go from, like you say, FA Cup winners, league winners, UEFA Cup winners, but then to take that next step. And it's not just a single step, and it's a, you know, it's a one-off European trophy, say for example like Villa. It becomes a period of dominance, but it's what happens between 74 and 77 that has kind of fascinated me for quite a while.
I think it's to do with many factors. I think definitely to do with the foundations. So Stephen's just summed that up brilliantly, really, is that this was an evolution that was going on before 1974. And I think we've talked about this on another show, but there's something about that kind of culture within the club and the kind of collectivism of the boot room that really interests me. Because what you had there is Shankly's clearly the figurehead, and he's clearly extremely influential, and he's a you know, one of the things you can say about Shankly is a decision maker. So Shankly will have made the decisions. But there's no doubt whatsoever in my mind that contributing to the decisions that Shankly made in terms of formation, tactics, style, all the rest of it, will have been huge amounts of input from Ronnie Moran, Joe Fagan, Bob Paisley. So what you've got in 1974, I think, is something that a project, to use a modern term, that's starting to come to fruition. And the kind of building blocks of the next great Liverpool side are now in place. And then what you've got is Shankly leaves. And a figure like that leaving in such circumstances, you know, from any club is devastating, potentially derailing. But because you have that sort of ethos of collectivism in the boot room, they're able to survive that as a kind of management structure. But then also that's obviously been bred into the team and the squad. And there's a great quote from Steve Highway where he's talking about Bob Paisley's first team talk when he comes and he announces that he's going to take over. And obviously, you know, famously, he's incredibly reluctant to take the job. And he tells the players on numerous occasions during the one meeting that he didn't want the job. But you know, the players rally round after that meeting and say, you know, we're going to have to pull our weight here. We're going to have to get behind Bob, or it's not going to work. So I think there's lots of things that Stephen's already talked about in terms of the evolution of the style of play, the players that were brought in. But I think, you know, when Bob takes over, it's a fantastic launch pad for him to then take it to the next level. And I don't think there's anything. I was talking to someone else recently, you know, about looking at title win, Liverpool title winning sides, and you know, whether it's the team of the 1920s or the 1947 team or the team of the 60s and the 70s, or whether it's the team under Klopp today, what they all have in common is that kind of real spirit of collectivism and fighting for each other. But at the very top of the club, this real sort of sense of solidarity and unity, between all the people who are in the management team. And I think that's really, really important in sort of Liverpool going from being UEFA Cup winners in 73 and winning their second FA Cup to then going on and dominating Europe afterwards.
It's a great point, Gary, that sort of Jeff's made there, and it kind of, for me, it really puts into sharp focus sort of where football is now, and you know, this almost instant success or almost disposable, it is literally a disposable industry that they're almost in. When you look at managers and the longevity of managers, you know, it's almost like a disposable a disposable job, and yet they don't seem to. Some clubs certainly still don't seem to realise that actually, like you say, solidarity at the top or this long-term plan, not this quick fix, is the way to kind of guarantee success.
Yeah. I suppose, you know, as a Chelsea fan who, a club who changed managers every 18 months but have still won, you know, plenty of pots in the last decade or so, they're probably the exception. But, you know, as a rule, you know, longevity of management or sort of an internal management succession does seem to be, you know, a better bet for success. I mean, look at Ferguson and Wenger, the success they had with the long years they were there at their clubs. But there's I can't remember the statistics, it might have changed, but a couple of years ago, I know the average tenure for a Premier League manager was just a dab over 18 months. Now, that's an average. So obviously, the managers of low clubs getting relegated is going to sort of pull that down. But, you know, instant success is a massive demand these days, and patience is a rarity. But, if history of football teaches us anything, you know, and you know, we should always learn from things that have come before us. The things that Liverpool did, you know, the way that Stevie and Jeff had just discussed, where, you know, the move from Shankly to Paisley, and then we're talking about afterwards with Ronnie Moran, Joe Fagan, and even Kenny Dalglish afterwards as well. You know, it's a pattern of success that perhaps no other club has repeated with any sort of similar success. But it's a pattern that Liverpool exploited massively well.
It's linked into the final big question, I guess, that I was going to ask Stephen, and that's, you know, do you think? I mean, obviously, you're Liverpool fans, and you're going to have to look at this objectively for me. But do you think that Liverpool Football Club have done this better than anyone else? You know, we talk about the boot room, we've talked about it a lot, and that succession of success, but the succession of managers as well that was tied in with that success. But in terms of clubs, you know, when you look at clubs worldwide, you know, are they the best exponents of what comes from patience, from the long-term plan, from belief and trust and faith, I guess, in decisions at management level?
Probably within an environment that's being as competitive as the one that they were involved in. You do get some countries and nations where it's a two-horse race, so, you know, two teams remain dominant for a period of time. You know, you can point to the Man United of the 1990s and the 2000s, yet it was one that was propelled by one man. You know, it one man was the ringleader of that. that, and that was Alex Ferguson. You know, for Liverpool to do what they did, I don't think there's anything quite like it, you know, to pass the baton from Shankly to Paisley to Fagan to Dalglish, because those four kept that going. You know, I think we've said it before on one of the recent podcasts, was that, you know, Man United have been champions of England 20 times. Yet only three men have won those 20 titles. You know, between 1973 and 1986, four different men won the title for Liverpool. You know, that's four in three in four seasons. If you want to just look at Paisley, Fagan, and Dalglish, you know, an incredible, you know, succession. Continuity was the word that John Smith, the chairman, always used to trot out, that sense of continuity. But evolution was the more correct word, because it was an ethos. As Jeff said, you know, a certain sense of the collective amongst that, which Jurgen Klopp has brought back so successfully in the last few years. You know, it is being big enough, because you do get some managers who are, you know, the epitome of everything. Everything has to be through them. And yes, the manager has to be the man who makes the decision in the end. But some managers will outsource some of the duties. You know, they'll give responsibilities to their coaches and the people that surround them. You know, and they are comfortable within doing that. And I think all of Liverpool's coaches of that era were like that. So hence the boot room era came to fruition. Hence you have, you know, a lot of responsibility that Jurgen Klopp now hands over to his lieutenants. And yes, I think Liverpool thrived on that. They were also very meticulous. You know, it's like the training logs. Every day, you know, a log was made of, you know, who was involved in training, what knocks, you know, anyone picked up. So to look for patterns, there were great pattern analysts at Liverpool. Yeah, it was all grounded in a certain sense of simplicity. So yes, to be able to do that, that particular eye of the storm that went from 76 to 84 in particular, that was surrounded, still bookended by epic success. I don't think there's been anything like it, certainly from an English football perspective. Like I say, you know, you can talk about Celtic and Rangers dominating to ludicrous effects, and other countries around Europe and beyond that have these omnipresent figures. But English football is quite unique in the, you know, an absolute collection of huge clubs that have huge histories, that have had periods of success, but none of them quite like this era of Liverpool, though.
It's always why, like I say, when, you know, when you guys are on, it's always so, I try to think as many questions as I can possibly ask to get the answers that I usually, or to questions that I'm usually, when I'm sat at work, supposed to be working, and actually I'm just thinking about football. But I am really grateful. Like we say, we're already at the hour, which we knew we would be, but said we wouldn't. Before I can't let you go, though, without your sort of key moment in the game, Jeff, it's your final. It's your game. You can have first pick of the entire 90 minutes.
Well, I think, you know, it's the third goal for me, for all the reasons that we've talked about. You know, the approach play, Tommy Smith's involvement. And you know, it's a tap in, I suppose, from Keegan, isn't it? But in some ways, that was so typical of Kevin Keegan, to just be in the right place at the right time and to be able to finish off the chance, and the kind of explosion of joy in the living room in Norris Green, Liverpool, in 1974, because, you know, that the game is absolutely over, and we know we're getting our hands on the FA Cup for the second time. So that for me, for pure nostalgic reasons, but also, you know, just for the sheer beauty of the moment, really. That's my highlight of the game.
Brilliant. I'm going to come to you last, Stephen, as the Liverpool. There has to be some penalty to pay for manipulating this episode.
I'd just add a bit extra there to Jeff's, though, was that if you're coming to watch that, do try and find the BBC version of the coverage rather than the ITV version. David Coleman's commentary to this match is one of the most iconic things ever. You know, from Keegan's opener that he describes as goals pay the rent and Keegan does his share, to the way that... drives that third goal. how Newcastle are undressed and
undressed.
Strip naked, he said, yeah.
It's an iconic piece of commentary that for Liverpool fans, you know, is that no other. There's only the toss of the coin between that or Barry Davis's call of the 77 European Cup final for the most iconic, you know, commentary calls of Liverpool matches ever.
I've always believed that commentaries are like lyrics to songs. You can hear a single line and you either know which song it's from or you know which game it's from. Gary, for you, your standout moment.
I'm a little cheat a little bit. There's one of the in the game and one sort of after the game.
You're gonna have two, aren't you? There's always two.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. And the one after the game I haven't seen but I've read about.
Okay.
So I'm sure it's true. But the one in the game, I'll take the Highways goal because that was the one that sealed the game. You know, I said there's always a danger of at 1-0. I mean, although you couldn't see Newcastle scoring if they played for another week, but you know, there's always that danger. So when Highways scored, it was pipe and slippers for the rest of the game after that. But after the game, and I read about this in one of the newspaper reports, I looked at the comment which newspaper it was, but apparently after the game, a few Liverpool fans came onto the pitch and sort of knelt down in front of Shankly on the bench and sort of did the sort of praise thing. And highly appropriate, because that guy did wonderful things for Liverpool and set them on a train of success, unmatched in the concentration of those next few years.
Brilliant. Stephen, you can't have two. Only Gary to be allowed to only ever have two.
Well, Jeff has quite rightly taken, you know, the that was mine, but
sorry.
But no. Jeff's episode, he definitely needs that one. But yeah, away from that, I'd have to look at the intrigue between the combinations between Phil Thompson and Terry McDermott in that game. Is that the two lads from Kirby, McDermott slipped the net, ended up at Bury from where he went to Newcastle. There's a part in that game, and people will always point out the Vinnie Jones challenge on Steve McMahon and the ATA Cup final and how that was, you know, made such a difference, whether you believe it or not. But yeah, there's a challenge in the 74 Cup final where McDermott's kind of like, you know, Newcastle's best player that day. You know, anything that's positive tended to go through McDermott. And he was running, he was just gaining a bit of pace around about the halfway line, running towards the Liverpool team. The game's 0-0 at the time. And Phil Thompson takes him down and leaves him with a bit of a limp for the rest of the game. But just a little bit. But then at the end of the match, they swap shirts. So when McDermott goes up to collect his runners-up medal, he's in a Liverpool shirt. And this is 5 months before he becomes a Liverpool player. And it's one of the most aesthetically jarring things in a way, because there's McDermott in a Liverpool shirt, looks absolutely correct in it, yet he's still a Newcastle player. And there's a brilliant, brilliant image, and I find it hard to find nowadays. You know, the legendary photographer Stephen Shakeshaft, who has an image of McDermott on the pitch after the game and the marching bands behind him, and he's got his arms folded and he just looks like thunder, because, you know, he's just been part of a Newcastle side that's been, you know, absolutely dissected by Liverpool. But he's within the Liverpool shirt and Liverpool celebrating, they've won the cup, but he's in a Liverpool shirt. He will become a Liverpool player in a few months' time. He's a Liverpool fan, and everything just looks so temporally bizarre in a way. You know, it's right, but it's not right. And it's always left a brilliant disorientation about those images for me.
Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant way to finish. Fellas, like I say, I by far get the best job in these, just listening to you guys chat. Jeff, as always, I knew it'd be brilliant the minute you put your name forward for one of these.
Oh, thank you. No, I've loved it. I've always said football, being a football fan, is about stories, isn't it, and shared memories. And, you know, this game for me is the mother load, really. I've absolutely loved it. Thanks for having me on.
Like I say, absolute pleasure. Gary, I feel like the series has kicked in. Now we've talked about a game of football.
Terrific. As you say, he said, you know, we always knew this was going to be a great episode, and knocked it out of the park, great. And, you know, couldn't have a better guest than Jeff to talk about success, you know, with Liverpool, and entertaining, informative, educational. The guy's got a lot. So thanks, Jeff.
Cheers, mate.
Stephen, I guess you've just been a bit bored, really, and not really interested in this one. Not really had much to say, not bothered.
Be a lot along for the ride on this one.
Not interested. Not interested. Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah,
I've phoned this one in, haven't I?
Guys, like I say, it's been brilliant. Episode 4 next. Gary, can you remember who we've got?
Or no.
Which game we've got?
No.
Excellent. That's okay.
No, I can't.
I think is it not Aidan?
And the second. Yeah, I think it is Aidan, but I can't. It's an international game.
It will be a Newcastle game, I know.
It's an international game, I think.
I think it's the 1970 World Cup final.
It is the 1970 World Cup final. Yes, it is. You're absolutely right, Stephen.
Stephen, you're not just here to talk about Liverpool. Well done.
I'm doing bored of them for some reason.
That's it. Guys, like I say, brilliant. Thank you for taking part. Thanks for the discussion. Thanks for the chat. Obviously, people who are watching and listening, thank you for joining. And please join us again next time on the end of the game. See you later.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.